because, well, when I was here before, I asked you to apply the voluntary payment doctrine on a class-wide basis, and you said no, and you said no because the evidence wasn't before the court. Well, it's a very good point, because when you're applying the voluntary payment doctrine, you have to look at that individualized inquiry, and that's why courts across the country have refused to apply, have refused to certify classes in these types of cases, because we have to go back. These are all sophisticated entities, by the way. And we have to look at the demand, the payment. Was there any interplay back and forth? Was there a negotiation back and forth? We simply don't know. But that's going to come up in all of these types of cases. The fact that the entirety of the collection files for each and every class member was submitted on summary judgment motions extremely telling, because I mean, you've seen the size of the record in this case, something like 74 volumes. What's the point of having a class action if you're actually looking and adjudicating all of the evidence as to each and every individual claiming? It just doesn't make any sense.
Talking about the summary judgment, because of the interest of time, the court concluded that, I guess your side didn't file an affidavit in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, so it was conceded. Is an affidavit necessary, but this type of case, but then I assume you're going to say no, but tell me why, and Mr. Abbs tell us why he thinks the affidavit is required.
Well, two reasons. First, because the evidence the plaintiff is relying on is the same evidence that the defendant is relying on. A demand for payment, a payment. And in the plaintiff's case, the amount they claim is supervisory liens. In the defendant's case, the demand for payment, the payment, and the absence of protest and any other evidence that would have gone into play. An affidavit doesn't move the ball any forward. I would also add that Rule 56 requires that the moving party prove that they have an entitlement to judgment as a matter of law. So you can't just have a default summary judgment. Even in the case of a default judgment, when I have to prove up here, I have to go to court, I have to go in front of a district court judge, prove my entitlement to the damages, and I don't always get what I'm asking for. I can't imagine that you would be able to get a default summary judgment.
Well, then the parties eventually stipulate to the amount in question.
They did stipulate to the
amount. So doesn't that kind of moot that argument out? Because if you arrive at a figure without conceding you owed it, but this is the amount in controversy, that seems to take care of that issue.
It takes care of the damages issue, but it doesn't take care of the liability issue.
I see.
And the court used, I think it was a belt and suspenders type of conclusion that because an affidavit was not filed, this is another reason why I can grant summary judgment on the merits. They may have stipulated to the amount of damages, but that's just assuming that the conclusion regarding the merits is correct, which my client didn't concede and was not correct.
Could you address the problem with not the class members did not go through mediation or arbitration?
Yes, Your Honor. And this is an NRS 38.310 issue. The class members did not go through arbitration or mediation. The arbitrator refused to certify a class, if you will. And so there were no class members in the arbitration. It appears at the district court level that the plaintiff recrafted its complaint to satisfy this court's unpublished opinion in Southern Highlands. And what they've said is, well, we're not challenging the validity of the lien. I don't think that matters because they were still challenging the amount of the lien, and when you're challenging the amount of the lien, I'm uncomfortable arguing the Southern Highlands case because it is unpublished, but this court has...
You can argue the Supreme Court case, you can cite to that, not the Court of Appeals one.
Okay. But this court has said that in those types of cases, the class, everyone needs to go through arbitration, and that did not happen here. Finally, there are many reasons for setting aside this judgment. Obviously, I don't have enough time. I still would like an answer from my esteemed opposing counsel as to what the business tort of conversion is and how that gets one into business court in the first case, at first place. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is James Adams, appearing on behalf of the class representative plaintiff
and the class members. I would like to reserve 3 minutes, if I may.
I think you're just, aren't you just defending this? You don't have a cross appeal.
That's true.
Okay.
Well, let me address specifically some of the issues raised by Mr. Riley and the defendant. One thing I think is very important for the court to recognize, and the Southern Highlands case obviously was similar to the case at bar. It was the original complaint that this court reviewed, and the court determined that the original complaint did address some CC&R issues. Now, NRS 38.310 says if you're going to file a complaint, it requires the application, enforcement, or interpretation of CC&Rs, one must go through arbitration first. It's now mediation. After the Southern Highlands order came out, the complaint was amended. And it was amended to conform specifically to the language, that is the Southern Highlands complaint, specifically amended to conform to the language of the order. Now, the order did a couple of things. What it did is it said, well, if all you're doing is you're concerned, your claim is concerned about the calculation of the super priority amount, then you can go directly to district court. It says that on page 10, both in the body of the page and in footnote 6. And so with that instruction, we then amended the complaints in these actions. And we amended them such that we complained not about the lien, because the decision also said if you've got problems with the lien itself, if you are complaining about the assessments, if you disagree with the assessments, if you disagree with the periodic budget, all of those would somehow be attached to the CC&Rs in some way, although that way hasn't been yet defined. So what we did was we took a look at the SFR decision, which actually is on point in this case as well. The SFR decision determines that there is a lien, and that lien is generated by NRS 116.3116 subparagraph 1. And it says the Homeowners Association has a lien for unpaid assessments. Now, subparagraph 2 doesn't just talk about priorities. It talks about, what part of that lien goes to the super priority piece and what part goes to the sub priority piece. So in our complaint in this case and in Southern Highlands, we say, okay, we agree with the lien. The lien is the lien. We agree with the amount of the assessments, no dispute there. We agree with the periodic budget, no dispute there. What this comes down to is what the court called the tabulation of the super priority amount. In short, what that means to me is that, there's a piece, as the court said in SFR, that goes to the super priority and a piece that goes to the sub priority. The entire lien isn't challenged. It's basically who pays what part. Do our class members have to pay more than the statute says? And they don't. Now for this, no reference to the CC&Rs is necessary because there is no dispute as to the assessments, the lien, or the periodic budget. So that is why we don't think NRS 38.310 required an arbitration, although we went through it anyway. This was years ago, before certain case law was made, and everyone got a little bit, on our side, maybe a little bit better understanding of the state of the law. The voluntary payment doctrine, that's an interesting issue.
I mean, my question on that, Mr. Adams, is why wouldn't that association service case apply to this case as well, as Mr. Riley argued? Tell me why you think it doesn't apply.
Yes. The But as far as the issue of the voluntary payment doctrine or the jurisdiction issue?
No, the issue of the voluntary payment doctrine.
Okay. The voluntary payment doctrine in the Southern Highlands case did not, well, the arguments, there were no arguments regarding that issue by anyone. I don't even think it came up once in the oral arguments as far as its relation to not the common law causes of action, but its relation to the statutory cause of action. It found its way in the order that this court dismissed or said the voluntary payment doctrine applies to a statutory cause of action, but it didn't say that. It just, that was one of the claims that was dismissed. It was nowhere in the order, it was nowhere argued. Since then, we took a closer look at that issue. And I'm not sure that was ever even contemplated in those papers at that time. We took another look at that issue, and we realized that NRS 116.1104, which, by the way, was not opposed in the lower court, that's the statute that says that NRS 116 cannot be altered by written agreement, and its rights may not be waived. So what we have here is...
But does that statute apply to these set of facts? Mr. Riley argued that that statute doesn't apply on the issue of whether or not you made a voluntarily payment. I'm just curious what your
right.
take
yeah,
is.
My response to that is the voluntary payment doctrine is a common law affirmative defense. And it's and this is where the slippery slope could happen. Because if we start applying a common law affirmative defense to other causes of action that our legislature actually passed into law, not only did they pass it into law, NRS 116.4117, it's the private right of action, the statutory private right of action, but it also passed NRS 116.1104, so you can't waive what's in NRS 116.4.
That language contemplates a prospective contractual waiver where, for example, I agree that this statute is not going to apply to me. To me, the voluntary payment doctrine is a horse of an entirely different color. It is like settling a claim. You can settle a claim, and in the course of settling a claim, certainly you're waiving rights, but it's not a prospective contractual waiver. And I just am struggling to accept that the voluntary payment doctrine, which is a post establishment of rights action that alters things, is the same thing as the prospective waiver outlawed in the statute.
My response to that is that I'm generally a literalist when it comes to statutes. The statute is very specific. It's not ambiguous. It says one cannot waive your rights under NRS 116, any rights you have under 116. Now,
so could you settle a 116 claim validly under your reading?
Well, that's a very good question. If it's an after injury settlement agreement, a written agreement that is agreed to by all parties, I'm not sure. I would say you probably can. But in this case, that never happened.
But what's the difference? I mean, why is it different? It's an after injury. The payment is made, not unlike a settlement. I agree, I don't want to argue with you anymore, so we'll compromise our differences. After the injury is inflicted, it involves no prospective waiver. I mean, I think it's ambiguous.
The statute itself, 116.1?
Maybe, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's clear in the sense that it says what it says. I think it is...
Most of them say that.
It's a legislative responsibility. Yeah. If they want to say, oh, well, you can accept... Actually, the actual statute says unless expressly provided otherwise in this statutory scheme. So certainly the legislature could say, gosh, we're gonna draft a statute saying that you can settle these particular claims. But in the SFR case, this court came down and said that utilizing 1104, that a written agreement basically cannot alter or modify NRS 116. Now, you were talking about the CCNRs. So there, a bank was saying, hey, you know what? We have priority because of the Mortgagee Protection Commission. And NRS 116, 3116, said, well, no, the Homeowners Association has priority. It's got a prioritized super priority amount. So I guess the same question can be posed there. Can there be a written agreement perspective that waives the rights of the Homeowners Association when it wants to foreclose and take a senior position to the bank? So, like I said, the statute says your rights cannot be waived. We did not waive our rights. In fact, it's been since 2010, I think, that we've been litigating these cases. It's been quite a number of years since the Nevada Real Estate Division and the Financial Institutions Division and the Attorney General came out and said 9 months is 9 months. That's your statute. You know, that's the super priority amount. And here we are today with a situation where there's no dispute that our clients paid too much. In fact, in the opposition to motion for class certification, on the first page, they actually say, yeah, it's 9 months plus all of these other fees and costs. So the Homeowners Association knew that they were charging more than 9 months. So it would be, and I'll get out of here pretty quick because I'm reserving the time, but to me, it would be a travesty to have a common law affirmative defense be able to trump a statutory right. Because then we're talking about, what about the FDCPA? What about the Nevada Deceptive Trade Practices Act?
Could you return for a moment to the question that Justice Gibbons began with here, which was not of you, but your opponent. And that is whether or not and there are any other exceptions to the voluntary payment doctrine that might apply here that were not developed in the case decided 3 years ago.
Yes.
And if so, what are they?
Yes, I believe those are contained in the briefing. I don't have them off the top of my head. It's about, in Southern Highland, or in Bielstrom, I call it the Bielstrom case, the voluntary payment doctrine. There are only two discussed in that case.
The duress and...
business necessity, I think.
Yeah.
There are multiple other exceptions.
Are there any that are invoked here that you would say would require remand were we to credit Mr. O'Reilly's argument?
One involved, there's one wherein this court stated, I think it was the voluntary payment doctrine case, where if there's a threat of additional fees or penalties, then that would take you out of the voluntary payment doctrine. I believe that's what the court said in that Elster case. That was just one example. But in that case, if the part recalls, actually, I think this was the Senator Hammond's case, where the court left intact the, no, it was the Piccoli case, where the court left intact the entirety of the class, their claims, because it is the responsibility of defendants to show that there was a voluntary payment. It's got to be voluntary, it's got to be a payment, it's got to, they've got to acknowledge as one of the elements that they in fact were charging too much. And it's got to be a known, let's say, voluntary payment. The last element of the voluntary payment doctrine is one that they've never been able to get over. They've never acknowledged that they've broken the law. And unless you acknowledge that as the third element, you can't prove that there was a voluntary payment as a third offense. And I think that my time has come to an end. Unless the court has any questions.
Any additional questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Riley, as you come up, I do have one question. I know you have a short period of time, but I think Mr. Adams made a pretty good argument here about the exemption from NRS 38.310. If this is a tabulation of the super priority amounts versus these other amounts, as opposed to getting into the CCNR. So what, I know you addressed that previously, but can you respond to his argument there?
It's a challenge to the tabulation of the amounts, and that's really the beginning and the ending of the NRS 38.310 argument. He's not challenging the validity of the lien, but he is challenging the amount of the lien, and to do that you have to incorporate the CCNRs and just follow on what's said in Southern Highlands.
Okay.
Mr. Adams said that he's a literalist when it comes to statutes, so I'm going to hold him to that. Because NRS 116.1104 doesn't mention the voluntary payment doctrine. It only mentions waiver. This is not a waiver in any shape, or form. And under the doctrine expressio unius est exclusio alterius, that which is not stated is excluded. The legislature would have put the voluntary payment doctrine into that statute if it had meant to take it out of NRS Chapter 116. It didn't do that. And to the contrary, in Section 1108, it embraced common law defenses. I'm also going to challenge him with regard to 116.4117. I'm looking at it right now. It's a violation of the statute if someone fails to comply with any of the provisions of NRS Chapter 116 or the declarations of bylaws. What provision of the statute did my client violate? I mean, NRS 116.3116 is a lien priority statute. I keep going back to that because it's so easy to throw out violation. What violation? Mr. Adams claimed that my client was seeking more than 9 months worth of assessments. Correct. That was before the Horizons case was decided by this court in 2016. And until that point in time, that was very much an issue for Nevada courts. Judges disagreed with NRED arbitrators, who disagreed with the NRED, who disagreed with the Commission on Common Interest Communities. I mean, there was a lot of time and money spent on litigation before this court resolved that issue. So how can you say that it's a violation of the law to have a good faith disagreement over the interpretation of a lien priority statute? I suggest to the court that argument cannot be made credible.
Could you offer your thoughts on your opposing colleague's comments about burden and voluntary payment doctrine? If you look at the Nevada Association Services case, which is the main voluntary payment doctrine case you're relying on, we said, the named plaintiff, the record didn't establish, the record established that the payment was voluntary, therefore the voluntary payment doctrine was appropriately invoked. But then it says, the record does not demonstrate, however, that petitioners presented any evidence to show that any other class member made a voluntary payment. Where are we trying to analyze this case against that yes, distinction?
Thank you. I may go over a little bit on this, but in the NAS case, Elsinore was the named plaintiff, and the evidence had been presented to the court, and my client had moved for summary judgment in that case, said, look, this is voluntary payment. So when it went up on a petition for ruling the Davis, this court said, yes, we see the voluntary payment by Elsinore, but we don't see it as to the rest of the class, therefore we can't issue a mandamus, which was absolutely correct. Inherent in that conclusion is that you have to look at the evidence when you apply the voluntary payment doctrine, which thereby precludes class certification. The lower court in this case deliberately sidestepped the voluntary payment doctrine so that a class could be certified. So I'm hoping, because Rule 23 is a tough rule, and I believe it's been the same for the last 47 years, I'm hoping that one of the takeaways is that this court can give guidance to other district court judges. I believe all but one of you were district court judges at one time, as to how to apply Rule 23. You can't just stop the analysis at Rule 23A when you see a common question of law, but that you really need to go through that rigorous analysis, which wasn't done here once the voluntary payment doctrine was kicked to the curb. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a comment, not a question on your NRCP 23. Justice Pickering and I have a committee we're co-chairing, it's working on revisions to the entire NRCP. 23 is under vigorous debate right now until both of you. So if you want to submit to us, you know, through the administrative docket, any thoughts you have on 23, what should be kept, what should be revised, please do so. We're looking forward to getting the input on that.
Stay noting that Justice Cherry is absent because of health. He will review the tape and the both video and audio, and he will participate in deliberations. With that, this matter stands submitted. Thank you.